I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being such loyal supporters. It's very, very touching. As I've said before, it's amazing.
It's very touching.
We get wonderful letters and messages. And
you're all so nice.
Very nice people. Very, very nice. And
you all like murder.
Oh. Yes, you do encounter the oddest people. I was in a cab this week, and the bloke says, I know who you are. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, you're that bloke with the natty clothes, talks about murder.
That's very funny.
He said, I really like those shows.
He's not wrong.
My wife loves them too, he says. I said, you should listen to the podcast then.
Good, he can listen to it in his cab.
In his cab, yes.
Well, that's very nice. Okay, just to repeat what I said last week about Patreon. We are doing a thing for our top tier Patreon members, but we want you all to participate, Patreon or otherwise.
Exactly.
Basically, what we would like is for everybody to write in to any of the places where you can write to us. So that's Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, our email, bloodties.podcast@gmail.com, and send us ideas for a case you would like us to do, but it has to be a famous person who has either committed a crime or been murdered. And then if you can submit all of your ideas by the 4th of December, then we are going to give them all, we're going to select our top three. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to give them to the Patreon top tier members, and they are going to choose who we do as our final Christmas episode, end of year shebang.
Okay.
And we're going to film us recording the episode. And as discussed, Geoffrey will be wearing a Santa's hat and a flashing waistcoat with mini reindeer on it.
Some chance.
And
of
he'll
that.
Be drinking
eggnog.
No, you
what
said you
about
don't
eggnog?
Like eggnog, so baby sham. I don't know. What does one drink at Christmas?
Champagne.
Champagne. You don't like champagne.
Well, but I don't mind the odd glass.
I like champagne.
I know, mate. We got some especially for your birthday.
Yeah, it was my birthday treat, the champagne.
Pink champagne we got.
Ooh, so special. Love it. Anyway, so please write in with your ideas of what you would like cases about famous people who have either committed a crime or been murdered. And the following 2 weeks, we are going to do Oscar Pistorius and Fatty Arbuckle, both of whom are famous people who were accused of murder.
Indeed.
We don't normally tell you our cases in advance, but it helps because it's part of what we're doing.
Yes, it is. And I, as I was saying, Mo, I looked at the whole Pistorius four-part series.
World's longest documentary.
Yes, and I've known the Arbuckle case for a very, very long time.
I chose that one for Geoffrey because it's right up his street.
Yeah, it's a wonderful case. Very, very interesting. Indeed, Pistorius is interesting, but I find it difficult. I'm not going to give away what I think, but I found it so difficult to be sympathetic. Yeah, I couldn't empathise in any way with Pistorius, but I'll do the case properly, I promise.
I know you will. We'll be interested to hear what people think. I did see that part on the documentary where they were saying it's like there's no middle ground with Pistorius. It's either he definitely did it or he definitely didn't.
That's
do
right.
It. But yeah. Anyway, we digress.
There is no middle ground.
There is no middle ground. We do digress.
And
so we've got to crack on because we're doing now today the second part of the Yorkshire Ripper. And then you'll remember the first part last week was pretty meaty. There's a lot going on. We've gone through 10 victims that we know about.
Yep.
We've gone through several lines of
failed inquiry. Yep.
More than one police force. So we better get on. So this is the Yorkshire Ripper part two.
We're now 1979. In April, Sutcliffe has committed the 10th killing, a young woman called Josephine Whittaker. The Wearside Jack recordings have come to the surface. George Oldfield has a press conference in which he plays the tape that Jack has sent him, and is convinced that this is the killer, and he's going to get him. Oldfield becomes almost obsessed, won't brook the possibility that the tape's a hoax, won't listen to a couple of Scotland Yard detectives who were asked to go up and investigate. It should be said that by the time we get into 1980, Mrs. Thatcher's now Prime Minister, Mrs. Thatcher was incandescent with rage that this man, who was now terrorising a whole sector of the north of England, was getting away with it, wasn't being caught. And at one point, she turned to Willie Whitelaw, who was her Home Secretary, and says, "I'm going to go up there, I'll find him." And Whitelaw said, "Ma'am, I think perhaps it would be better not for you to do that." But Whitelaw himself did go visit the inquiry, talk to Oldfield, recommended a couple of experienced experienced Scotland Yard detectives who went up to advise Oldfield. Oldfield paid no attention.
Oldfield doesn't sound like the one to me.
Well, it was a very fine copper, but this was a very, very big inquiry. It's the biggest hunt there'd been in British police history at that point. I mean, it was a massive inquiry. I'll get the figures, but I mean, they are extraordinary. Hundreds of thousands of statements and actions, and they've got the Wearside Jack inquiry, they've got the £5 note inquiry, they've got the cars inquiry, they've got, you know, the tyre moulds inquiry. And of course, they've also got, which I've always enjoyed about this inquiry, they've decided to put covert policemen in all the red light districts in Leeds, Bradford, Manchester, Halifax, to note down the cars that are touring, clearly with the prospect of picking up a sex worker. The list is astonishingly large, and it even shocked the police. One of the police women working, there weren't many police women working in Leeds Bradford at that point, but she said, "I never realised there were so many men. I thought there'd only be a few cars." No, there were hundreds of them. And as she said, there were all kinds of people, everything from bishops to, you know, respectable doctors.
Mm.
And she said, I was amazed. And of course, one of the names that appears on the list, in fact, he appears on three lists, three separate red light areas, is, of course, Peter William Sutcliffe. Peter William Sutcliffe.
And they didn't cross-check it with the £5 note inquiry.
They didn't cross-check it with the £5 note inquiry. There were four separate cards for Sutcliffe in their index system. Two of them with his name the wrong way round, William Peter Sutcliffe, and two of them with the wrong date of birth.
Jesus.
Now, Sutcliffe has been interviewed repeatedly, and every time he says, "No, I wasn't there. It must have been somebody else. Somebody else's car. It's not me. Nothing to do with me." And that's how it was meant. Oldfield by now is he's existing on a diet of Scotch whiskey and Craven A cigarettes. I mean, it's old-fashioned policing here. We're not talking about CSI. This is, you might call this black and white television police work. You can almost hear the Zed Cars theme in your mind, or softly, softly. However, the 11th killing takes place on the 1st of September 1979. A woman called Barbara Leach, who was 20. She was a university student, and she had been in the pub with her friends and was attacked. He pulled over in his car, attacked her with a hammer before stabbing her with the same screwdriver he'd used on Josephine Whittaker not long ago. He stuffed her body underneath the steps leading up to her back door. Once again, he's interviewed. Nothing to do with me. I was at home. I was decorating with Sonia. It's almost unbelievable. In fact, if it weren't true, it would be unbelievable. In 1980, Sutcliffe is arrested, believe it or not, not for any of these killings, but for being drunk in charge of a motor vehicle. Drunk driving. He's charged, and of course he has to wait for his court case to come up. So, you know, it takes a long time for these cases to come before the court. And so that happened in April 1980. In August, he kills again a woman called Marguerite Walls, who was a civil servant. She was murdered on the August the 20th, 1980. She worked in the Department of Education and Science in the town of Pudsey, near Leeds, and had been working late to make up some extra hours before going away on holiday the next day. She walked about half a mile back towards her house, and Sutcliffe stopped his car and attacked her with a hammer and then strangled her with a rope. Her almost naked body was found in a garden, partially covered by leaves. And then in November, the last victim that we know of, a girl, woman, 20 years old, called Jacqueline Hill, who was a student at Leeds University. She was murdered on November the 16th, 1980. She's in her third year of a degree in English and had been at a seminar in the city centre and was catching a bus back home. Walking the final 100 yards, she was followed by Sutcliffe, who hit her on the head with his familiar hammer and stabbed her. She suffered 4 skull fractures. It was then, after the 13th victim, that the Prime Minister had to be talked out of going to pursue the inquiry herself. In fact, as far as we know, Sutcliffe did not kill again, but at least not in this sequence of 13. One of his friends, an old friend of his actually, called Timothy Birdsall, wrote to the West Yorkshire police anonymously and saying that he thought that they should interview Sutcliffe again. The suggestion was either lost or ignored. He even turned up at the police station himself and said, "I do think you should interview Peter Sutcliffe."
Because people must have, like Sonia and people must have been able to tell that he was up to something weird. Like, well,
it remains an undying mystery. And one of the mysteries of this entire case is how come nobody knew. But I'm not suggesting for one moment that Sonia did know.
No, I don't mean it like that. But, you know, if somebody could be like, "I just got a feeling that he's up to something."
Yes.
You would just like have a, "Where have you been, darling? Why do you keep going out at night time at the same time that I hear these women are being killed?" Like, do you know what I mean? It doesn't.
Where'd you go in your car?
Yeah.
But of course, he's changing his cars regularly now. He swaps a white Ford Corsair for a red one. Then he gets a Sunbeam Rapier. Then he gets a Rover. And it's the Rover, believe it or not, that is his eventual undoing. It's now the 2nd of January, 1981. And Sutcliffe has picked up a sex worker in Sheffield called Olivia Reavers. She's 24 years old. And two bobbies in a car spot this Rover parked up in a fairly derelict bit of Sheffield. And they've got the number plate recognition, a very early form of number plate recognition. They radio the office and the office tap it into. They haven't got one of those things on board now, which everyone's got, you know, ANPR. And they discover that it's got false number plates. So they arrest Sutcliffe, and Olivia Reavers is allowed to make away. They arrest Sutcliffe and take him to the police station, Dewsbury Police Station. The next day, these two coppers are bright enough to go back to the place where they found the Rover and Sutcliffe and look over the wall beside where the car has been parked. They discover a knife, a hammer, and a rope. Sutcliffe, ever quick on his feet, when they said to him, "We're arresting you because these are false number plates," he said, "Oh, I'm bursting for a pee. Just let me go and have a pee." He's taken these things with him and thrown them over the wall.
Smart.
Now they return to interrogate Sutcliffe, who at the outset denies everything. But then he makes what is the most astonishing confession. It's very long.
Just out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere. He says, "I'm the Ripper." It was dictated, and again, you see, so interesting about this case. It wasn't the senior officers who interviewed Sutcliffe. It was two comparatively junior officers. It's extraordinary that it's as though even now, when he should be an absolute slam dunk, you know, it's obvious, I think they still thought that it wasn't him. Until he finally started to say, "Well, actually, I'm the Ripper." I'll read you Michael Bilton, who I think wrote by far the best book on the Ripper. He said, "Peter Sutcliffe's voluntary statement of confession and the transcript of his various interviews remain the most compelling pieces of hard evidence in the Yorkshire Ripper case. They provided the basis of his prosecution for 13 murders and 7 attempted murders. Long portions of what Sutcliffe told the police were read to the jury at his trial and were then widely reported. More than 20 years after Sutcliffe was jailed, it's surely right these documents should be included here." And Bilton's book includes the complete statement plus the subsequent interviews. But I think it's worth just reading the beginning. "I, Peter William Sutcliffe, wish to make a statement that I want someone to write down what I say. I've been told that I need not say anything unless I wish to do so, and that whatever I say may be given in evidence. That was the incident that started it all off. I was driving through Leeds late at night. I'd been to somewhere, have a couple of pints. You'll know the date better than me. It was Wilma McCann. I was in a Ford Capri K register, a lime green one with a black roof and a sun grill in the back window. I saw this woman thumbing a lift where the Weatherby Road branches to the right, but you can carry straight on. She was wearing some white trousers and a jacket. I stopped and asked her how far she was going. She said, 'Not far, thanks for stopping,' and she jumped in. I was in quite a good mood, and we were talking on the way. She said something about just before we stopped. To me, I didn't know what she meant. I asked her to explain, but she didn't pay any attention. I think he may have thought that she was a prostitute, but she wasn't. And not surprisingly, she didn't know what he was talking about.
A sex worker.
Do forgive me. She told me where to park the car. It was just off the road. We turned left. It was a misunderstanding. Sutcliffe tries to present it as though she belittled him. You know, he wasn't capable. He suddenly said, "I suddenly felt myself seething with rage. I got out of the car, wanting to hit her to pay her back for the insult. I went to her and I said, 'Hang on a minute, don't go off like that.' She was only 3 or 4 strides away. It's as though Sutcliffe is painting himself as, in a sense, always the victim, never the guilty party.
What, because someone's been mean to him?
Yes. But I think it does play a little bit to what I said at the beginning of part one, that Sutcliffe had this extraordinary desire to be, you know, to take revenge on women. And time after time, in his first statement, he talks about, I don't think I had any blood on me following this one. I can't recall what I was wearing then. I cannot remember what I did with the knife. I must have taken it home with me and washed it. I feel I may have left it in the Corsair when I scrapped it. The hammer may have been the one I threw over the wall at Sharp Sprinter's. When I saw in the papers that Jane McDonald was so young and not a prostitute, I felt something like someone inhuman, and I realised it was a devil driving me against my will and that I was a beast. When the Ripper came up in conversation at work or in the pub, I was able to detach my mind from the fact that it was me they were talking about.
So weird.
It's a chilling document. It does repay reading, because it's a catalogue of horror. He says, for example, shortly before the killing of Barbara Leach, "My urge to kill remained strong and was totally out of my control. The next victim of mine was Barbara Leach in Bradford. At that time, in September 1979, I had my Rover 3.5. I think I'd been working on my car one Saturday night and took it out for a run. I had the urge, which was in me, and I went to look for a victim. It was so late, I drove straight into town and then found myself going up by the university. When I reached the Manville Arms, I had just passed it when I saw a girl who I later found out was Barbara Leach. She was walking up the road." It's an extraordinary document. And I think it's worth pointing out that, as Michael Bilton puts it, we now know Sutcliffe was responsible for many more crimes of savage violence against women and men. Yet he still denies virtually all of those, even though the evidence against him is utterly compelling. The suspicions of several experienced detectives should have been thoroughly explored during the period of Sutcliffe's interrogation. Yet the moment he put up his hand to being the Ripper, the Yorkshire Ripper, the heat was on to take his statement as quickly as possible. It turned out to be a ridiculously hurried affair, a policy seemingly aimed at satisfying the interests of public relations by getting the notorious killer before a magistrate's court as quickly as possible. The failure by West Yorkshire Police at the time to question Peter Sutcliffe more thoroughly was an elementary and costly error. Things did not, I fear, get all that much better. Sutcliffe is charged with 13 murders and 7 attempted murders, the ones he's admitted. And he pleads not guilty on grounds of diminished responsibility.
What for? Insanity?
Yes. Even more horrifying is that this plea of accepting manslaughter and not murder is accepted by the prosecution, which was led, believe it or not, by the then Attorney General, Sir Michael Havers. Havers is perfectly prepared to agree with the defence that they will accept a manslaughter guilty and they won't pursue the murder. Again, I find it utterly bewildering. But now comes a really good judge. Mr. Justice Boreham, later to be Sir Leslie Boreham, says he's not prepared to accept this. He thinks that if it's a case of Sutcliffe being mad or bad, it's for a jury to decide. So Boreham throws out the plea agreement and Sutcliffe goes on trial for murder. It was a 2-week trial. There have been 4 psychiatrists examining Sutcliffe, all of whom think he is actually a paranoid schizophrenic, probably, but they're not absolutely certain, and it's certainly... The only flaw in the case of Sutcliffe being deranged is when one prison officer tells the court that during his period in prison, he's heard Sutcliffe tell Sonia he might only get 10 years in a loony bin. I think that might have been what you might describe as the straw that broke the camel's back.
Mm.
Because it then becomes but blindingly apparent that Sutcliffe is a devious, manipulative, cold-hearted and self-centred, vain individual. The jury, to their eternal credit, find him guilty. Mr. Justice Boreham said in his summing up he was beyond redemption and hoped he would never leave prison. He gave him a minimum of 30 years And in July 2010, the High Court in London amended it to a whole life tariff. The aftermath of the Ripper trial and the literally the terrorisation of a whole part of the north of England. I mean, women were literally terrified to go out at night. They had to go out in twos or threes. Every headline said, for God's sake, don't go out alone. You know, be careful. Even the red light districts, had, you know, they were much more careful and they were all keeping a watch out for one another and noting who got into which car and things like that. I mean, it was, this was enormous, enormous story and an enormous event in the north of England. But it had many bits of fallout. In particular, one of the former Chief Inspector of the Constabulary, Sir Lawrence Byford, was instructed to report on the conduct of the inquiry and indeed the work of George Oldfield and the major incident room.
I feel like that probably didn't go well.
Byford was absolutely coruscating in his description of what went wrong. He talked about misogyny among the West Yorkshire police, about disregard for prostitutes as people, sorry, sex workers as people. It was a really brutal attack, which, I mean, in fact, Oldfield retired, had a heart attack and was dead within 2 years.
Not surprised.
Byford called Sutcliffe, and I like this description of him, an otherwise unremarkable young man. And I think that's rather true. And I think it's one of the reasons why it was so difficult to connect this rather shy, mild-mannered little chap in this house in Bradford with a garage which was full of tools. Of course, when they search his house, they find all sorts of tools in the garage. With a man who could commit 13 murders and 7 attempted murders. In prison, he gets sent to Parkhurst after a conviction. He's attacked, of course, not unusual. But then he's diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia again. He goes to Parkhurst in 1981. In 1984, he goes to Broadmoor, always regarded as a very cushy billet, a special secure hospital where they get lots of Scrabble and they play games and get pizzas delivered. Sutcliffe is diagnosed as capable of leaving Broadmoor in 2009. Well, he's been there already for 25 years, but he doesn't actually leave Broadmoor until August 2016 when he goes to HMP Franklin in Durham, which is where, in the end, he died in November 2020. He'd had 2 heart attacks recently and then had caught COVID-19 and refused treatment. He was aged 74. Sonia had remained loyal and indeed remained married to him for some years. She didn't actually finally divorce him until 1994. And when she married a hairdresser, or hairstylist, I'm sorry. They lived for a time somewhere else, but she went back to live in the house. She said, my castle, nothing bad ever happened in it.
Wow, that is strong.
And she, and the husband wouldn't live there.
I'm not surprised.
It is remarkable. Sonia is alive and well.
She's still in the house?
Still in the house, as far as I know, yes.
Oh, my word.
Yes, there's quite a recent picture of her somewhere, actually.
Sonia.
Someone once called her a very cold woman. I'm no way of judging, but she's certainly remarkable. She made a lot of money from suing newspapers for saying she knew he was doing it. Yes, there she is.
Geoffrey showed me a picture of Sonia.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. There you go.
Yep. As the... she was very loyal. But she was, you know, strange, I think it would be fair to say. She now actually works as a stress counsellor. Where do you think Sutcliffe wants his ashes to be scattered? It's actually a good answer.
At the house?
No, Paris.
Paris?
Where Sonia and he went on their honeymoon.
Oh, my God. What an odd couple.
Yes. Of course, he'll be cremated, and the site of the cremation. I mean, there's always fantastic to do about serial killer cremations. I mean,
does he get to choose? You don't get to choose where your ashes are scattered, do you?
Well, you can do if you want to.
But who would what? Sonia'd have to take them.
Yes. Oh well, Dennis Nielsen wanted his ashes scattered in Fraserburgh, where he's born. And Fred West's ashes became a subject of a wonderful tug of war between Anna Marie and Stephen, two of his children. I mean, at one point she stole them and ran off in the night with them. Then Stephen got them back again, and they are scattered in Barry Island in Wales, where he used to go a lot of camping.
I was talking to Des about Fred West. He said that he bought ice cream from him once. They lived in Scotland, didn't they?
Yeah, he ran over a little boy with his van at one point, killed him. But I think if you look at the whole case, and it is a remarkable, remarkable case, I think things that stick in your mind were the car tyres, the £5 note, the footprint, the boot prints, Wearside Jack, and all the time.
Do you remember it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very much so. The cars, and that tape. I mean, I can still hear the voice. Oh, we should actually just put a little parenthesis in there.
Mm-hmm.
The real Wearside Jack, the man who sent the tape, was eventually identified by DNA many years later. His real name was John Samuel Humble. And he was an unemployed alcoholic from Sunderland who in 2006 was given 8 years in prison for perverting the course of justice. And, he'd even rung up himself, West Yorkshire Police, and said it's a hoax.
Oh, my God. It's a litany of disasters.
And sadly, Humble died in 2019 at the age of 63. There's almost nothing about this case which isn't extraordinary.
Mm.
But I suppose the most extraordinary thing of all, as we've seen so often, is that Sutcliffe was hiding in plain sight.
He didn't even try and hide.
Not at all. And that's what makes him, in many ways.
And he didn't hide the bodies. Everybody else hides the bodies.
Yeah, no, he occasionally covered them with some planking.
I know, but Gacy put them in the crawl space. West buried them in the garden.
Yeah.
You know, but he didn't even, he just left them.
Yes, dumped them like rubbish.
Like, it's mad, that's mad that you can't get, like, it's, yeah, it's mad.
Well, it's the same as that, the man called the Grim Sleeper in LA, Nolly Franklin. He just...
The garbage guy.
The garbage guy. Yeah. Well, here we go. That is Peter Sutcliffe.
The Yorkshire Ripper.
The Yorkshire Ripper.
Thanks, Dad.
We'll talk about something cheerful for a minute or two, shall we? I know what you've bought yourself for your birthday, but what about... Are you going to go anywhere? Oh, no,
I can't do anything.
We're all locked in, aren't we?
Well, by the time this comes out, I won't have done anything. I'm allowed to meet various people outside on my own to drink a beer in the cold. So
okay.
I'm doing that. I did that. We'll have done that with a few people. No, other than that, there isn't much news. It's nearly Christmas. It's funny, I think everybody thinks that there'll something miraculous will happen in on the 1st of January and like a big wand will sweep away all the COVID and then everything will go back to normal.
Absolutely the
that
opposite.
That isn't going to happen.
No, we're going to go back into another lockdown, I think. Lockdown 3.0.
3.0.
Yep. And I wouldn't be surprised if there weren't a lockdown 4.0 after that. We're not going to see the end of this in any way until summer.
I like it when Dad makes his predictions, because when COVID first happened, he went, we're not going to be anywhere back to normal till September. And then it got closer to September, we're not going to be even closer back to normal until.
Yes, Mike, it's constantly going forward, isn't it, Mo? Yeah. But I think, you know, I think we'll get better at living with it. Let's put it that way. That we're already, you can see us adapting. And the vaccine obviously is going to help eventually. But it won't be the 1st of January 2021.
It's just so hard to tell, isn't it? Because it's just so, like, you can do certain things and not other things. And
well, I think it is extraordinary. I mean, I have a dear friend who pointed out to me last week, he said, well, I can have an electrician into my house to mend the fuses, but I can't have my daughter.
Mm.
That makes no sense to me, he says.
Mm. It's very odd.
It is.
But hey ho, I am sticking to the rules. The more of us that do,
the better it is
for
everyone.
And
I am sticking to the rules too. I have barely been anywhere.
So that is the thing to do, and I'm very lucky because I'm allowed one bubble and my bubble is you.
Thank you. And we are very lucky because we have our listeners in our bubble.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we've got roofs over our heads and we have ways of, we're comfortable, so we're very lucky, I think.
We are very lucky.
In comparison to a lot of people.
And we're very lucky to have such wonderfully loyal listeners.
Thank you all so much for listening. Hope you've enjoyed that. Oh, is that the right word? No. I don't know, but anyway, thank you very much to all the people that help us. Our producer, Sam Brain, my brother Dan, who did the music, my friend George, who drew our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, and to Jeffrey for all of his hard work and putting himself through a week's worth of heavy Yorkshire Ripper study. Thank you. And to you, the listeners, without you, we're nothing.
Thank you so much. And I have to thank Mo because this was her idea. And thank you all for listening. And as I say, and as the Yorkshire Ripper proves, bad things happen to good people. So do please be careful out there.